The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. I want to thank Robert Morley, who filled in for me yesterday. He's been off on quite a few other duties of late, so we don't get to hear him as often on Trumpet Hour or filling in on this program. So it was good to hear him dig into the subjects that he really does specialize in. As he might have mentioned, we were out of power most of the afternoon, resorting to the dim light that the outside was providing. It was a pretty cloudy day most of the afternoon, and then of course using flashlights and candles. But the power came on right at the end of the day, the workday for us over here at Edstone, about 5 p.m., and everything returned back to normal. I did get this one email from one of you listeners. I tweeted about the candles we were using yesterday, and he says here, there's just too much candle power in God's work for the systems of this world to handle. All the candle power of all church ages combined must now shine as one great light for the brightest message ever in this last dark hour on earth. Better for Edstone's electrical supply problem to be fixed right now and for all devices to be made ready for the work ahead. And he brings up a good point there at the end. We really are, I think, getting ready for what's coming. It's going to be such a momentous year. It already has been in many respects, and but some of these articles that I'll bring to your attention, particularly the ones coming out of Europe, they keep referring to just how momentous 2017 is going to be for Germany and for the European Union. In any event, it was nice yesterday just getting back to some of the some of the basics, I guess, shutting off some of the machines and just doing what we could with what we had. I can tell you right now, I guess there's a big ice storm in Edmond on the other side of the pond, and we just learned that school was canceled at the academy for today. So we've got some excited academy students here at Edstone, as they're now baking in the kitchen and sawing down logs or wood outside, taking advantage of the time that they have away from school. It started out as a snowy day, not a lot of accumulation, but a little bit of a snowy day this morning, but the sun has since come through. And so the IA children are out of doors or inside cooking and enjoying their time away from school. So hopefully the ice storm there in Edmond won't bring the power down there. In any event, there's a lot to get to on today's show. In fact, there's so much to get to. I almost hesitate rattling off some of the items I'd like to talk about, because I just have a feeling I'm not going to finish with everything. I came down here today with too many notes, but we'll see. We'll see how that we can do. I'd like later in the second segment, if we have a chance, to get into some material that I hope to use for a television program or a taping later this afternoon on just talking about the paradox that Herbert Armstrong so often spoke of in the world today, where you have all of this modern sophistication and at the same time so much darkness spiritually, and how it is that we should go about searching, diligently searching, for God's truth, for that light, that candle, so to speak, as you heard about there in that email that came in. We'll talk here in a moment about President Obama's decision yesterday to end the exemption for Cubans arriving here, or arriving in the United States, I should say, without visas. It seems like a strange decision coming from this particular administration. We'll look more at that in just a second. The militarization of Europe, this is an ongoing story that we're probably going to be talking about almost every other day here in 2017. Because Europe is moving forward with its own plans. Europe is remilitarizing itself. And when you put that together with another eye-opening piece, I think it comes from The Week. Richard Palmer gave it to me this morning. The myth of America's invincible military. Times are changing. Technology is changing. And how will this affect warfare? How will this affect world war? It's something to think about. An eye-opening piece, Richard was saying as he gave it to me this morning, that this is almost exactly what he was thinking of writing about for the Trumpet. Hopefully he'll follow through and do that. In any event, he's got some, at least one article here to work from. But we've touched on some of the other things, even that this article brings out, as I say, we'll come to that in just a second. But let me start with this first. This was from a couple of days ago, and it's from MRC TV, or the Media Research Center, I believe it is, about the deportations drop, how that they've dropped 73% under President Obama. It's now at a 43-year low. This is just deportations in general. America's authorities sending them back across the border when they come in illegally. It says here, deportations of illegal aliens living inside the United States have tanked 73% since 2009 when President Obama first took office. And this is according to a new report from the Center for Immigration Studies. It says here, CIS analyzed the most recent annual report released by the Department of Homeland Security. So, I mean, this is coming from the government itself. Analyzing the report coming from the Department of Homeland Security, which states that U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement removed 65,332 illegal aliens from the interior of the U.S. last year. So just over 65,000. It says the Immigration Analysis Group noted that those 65,000 or so deportations reflect a 73% drop in interior removals since 2009, when roughly 240,000 illegal aliens were deported from inside the United States. Now, over these past 8 years, of course, we've told you a lot about these sanctuary cities breaking laws, the lawlessness that's going on just to accommodate all of these illegal aliens, and then just the number of criminals that we're letting in, robbers, rapists, murderers, and the number of criminals that we're letting out of jail so that they can return to these sanctuary cities. It says here, CIS added that the number of criminal aliens, ICE deports, or ICE, annually has decreased by about 60% over the last 8 years. So it's not just across the board for those that come here to just earn a better living. This is across the board also with respect to the criminals. The criminals. We're not sending them back. It says last year, ICE reported they had removed 60,318 criminal aliens who'd been living inside the United States. And that makes up most of the number, about 98% of that 63,000. CIS notes the number of criminal aliens removed dropped by about 4% between 2015 and 16, and 60% from its peak in 2010, when about 150,000 criminal aliens were sent home. And so you see the trend. I mean, it's just tanking, as it says in the first paragraph of this piece. And yet, as we learned yesterday, here comes the Obama administration ending the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy for Cuban refugees, for those who are fleeing Cuba. This was a policy put in place during the Clinton administration back in the mid-1990s, and basically, just to summarize what the policy means. If Cubans were, and you know how many Cubans are trying to get across into the United States on rafts or boats or whatever they can get on to get to the U.S., if they were caught at sea while they were trying to get to the United States, then they were sent back to Cuba. That was the policy. But those who made it to Florida or elsewhere, mostly Florida, I guess, those who made it to Florida were then eligible for residency in the United States, even though they didn't have visas, even though they didn't have the paperwork. So why would the Cubans be given this kind of special treatment? Well, according to U.S. policy, again, this is something established back in the mid-1990s, they were viewed differently because they were seen as fleeing Castro's prison in Cuba. They were seen as refugees, not as illegal immigrants. And so what this decision means, the one that was made yesterday by President Obama, is that Cubans fleeing their island are no longer going to be treated as refugees by U.S. authorities. And presumably they'll be sent right back to Cuba, even if they make it to land. Here's how the New York Times reported on it this morning. It says, President Obama said Thursday that he was terminating the 22-year-old policy that has allowed Cubans who arrived on the United States or on United States soil without visas to remain in the country and gain legal residency, an unexpected move. Notice this, an unexpected move long sought by the Cuban government. So this was an arrangement made yesterday with the Cuban government. And you know all about the recent history, the last year and a half or so, when, according to President Obama, I mean, everything's normalized. It didn't work the past 50, 60 years, and I've come along and I've restored and normalized relations. It says here, it's quoting from Obama's statement, effective immediately, Cuban nationals who attempt to enter the United States illegally and do not qualify for humanitarian relief will be subject to removal consistent with U.S. law and enforcement priorities. And so here now, he's the law and order president. Here now, it's got to be, well, it's got to be the same as with other nations. We've got to treat Cuba just like we would treat Mexico or those coming in from Central America. There's no difference. It says, by taking this step, we're treating Cuban migrants the same way we treat migrants from other countries. The move places a finishing touch on Mr. Obama's efforts as president to end a half century of hostility between the United States and Cuba. See, that's what it's really about. It's about normalizing these relations with this communist, tyrannical government, this abusive government in Cuba. The Times says here, the so-called wet foot, dry foot policy, which dates to 1995, owes its name to its unusual rules which require Cubans caught trying to reach the U.S. by sea to return home, yet allow those who make it onto American soil to stay and eventually apply for legal permanent residency. It was one way in which the United States tried to weaken Fidel Castro's government by welcoming tens of thousands of Cubans fleeing repression. Tens of thousands fleeing repression, not just leaving a bad economy, but fleeing repression. There's a difference, in other words, between refugees and illegal immigrants. It says here, this is the AP, the Cuban government praised the move. Well, they're ecstatic. Raul Castro, his regime, they're ecstatic. They're praising the move. And they've given no assurances about how they're going to treat those sent back to the country. What do you suppose they'll do? How do you suppose they'll be treated, those that are sent back? Here again, you have the Obama administration doing anything and everything for these dictatorial regimes and then getting nothing in return, just like with the Iran nuke deal. And then all the while, sending the message out that, hey, relations are great. And, of course, you know what the radical left says about that communist regime and about Cuba itself. Well, there's a lot of good things that you can see that they've done. They've got great schools. They've got great healthcare program. People, I guess, are flooding into Cuba from all over the world to try to get health care. We're supposed to believe. Senator Bob Menendez, he yesterday accused the administration of turning its back on people fleeing persecution. It's just like whatever you would expect as an American, it's the opposite. I mean, here, Cuba, they already have a wall because there's an ocean there. And then there's a communist dictatorship with its thumb on all of the people of that island. And so the president, his administration, is going to make it even more difficult. Meanwhile, there at the southern border of the United States, all across Mexico, it's a wide open door. It's a wide open door. And anyone and everyone can come in. Men, women, children, criminals, rapists, murderers, you name it. It's pretty amazing. Another Cuban in Congress, Ilania Ross Lettinen, she came across with her family when she was 7 years old. And she said that for Obama to eliminate this refugee policy, that he did this because that's what the Cuban dictatorship wanted, and the White House caved in to what Castro wants. That's what it boils down to. On the surface, as I say, it can seem confusing. Why would he clamp down on Cuban refugees while the border's just wide open all across the South? Well, this is what it boils down to. Another concession to a dictatorship. And I'm sure it's also meant to kind of box Donald Trump into a corner as well. I mean, if anyone would clamp down on it, you would think Trump would, given all the things that he campaigned on. And now he's coming into office with something that's controversial. Of course, the Cuban Americans in Florida are going to be very upset about this policy. And Florida is always a swing state. And so he's caught between a rock and a hard place, because there's also lots of followers of Trump that want to see more protection, that want to see stricter border controls. 7 days before President Obama leaves office, and it was just a few weeks ago, wasn't it, when he really stuck it to Israel. He's not through. He's got 7 more days. I mean, and it's not just the Obama administration trying to stick it to Trump. Of course, the big news this week in the United States with the story that was released by BuzzFeed and I think CNN, all of this stuff about how the Russians apparently were rigging the election and had something they were holding over the head of Donald Trump. And it turns out to just be a fake news, as Donald Trump said on Wednesday. They're coming after him. They're coming after him. Now, look, there's a lot of things about Donald Trump that we know are not going to work out the way that he says they will. But he's got a radical leftist media, and he's got a lot of radical leftist politicians that are going to do anything and everything they can to bring him down, before he even gets started. It's going to be fascinating to watch, and also, frankly, it's going to be sad to watch as the United States turns inward, having to deal with all of its internal problems and divisions, all of the strife, all of the hatred, the racism, the anarchy in the streets, even as these other world powers militarize themselves, as they prepare for war. Joschka Fischer had a column, I think it was in the German publication Süddeutschen Zeitung. I probably mispronounced that. Sorry for our German listeners. In any event, there was an English version of this piece that was at Project Syndicate, and he's in this guest columnist role, calling for Europe to militarize itself. He's saying this is going to be a decisive year for Europe. He mentioned a lot of the same things we've been talking about of late. All of the elections coming up in France and Germany and the Netherlands. And probably Italy as well. And that all of these factors, I mean, they're all coming together at the same time, and it's going to decide the fate of the European Union. And then you throw in Donald Trump's inauguration on January 20th, next week, a week from today. Fisher says that in itself, the inauguration, may someday be remembered as a watershed moment for Europe. We've talked a lot, as I say, in recent weeks about how a Trump administration is going to impact the European Union and Germany in particular. Fisher says in this piece that, you know, we should be preparing, we in Europe, we should be preparing for some profound shocks in the weeks and months ahead. It says here, the consequences for the EU will be even more serious if, in addition to setting the U.S. relationship with Russia on a new foundation, Trump continues to call into question America's security guarantee for Europe. Such a move would be at the expense of NATO, which has institutionalized the U.S. security umbrella for more than six decades. That's what we see coming to an end. The end of this post-World War II order. Fisher says Europeans would suddenly find themselves standing alone against Russia, that has increasingly employed military means to challenge borders, such as in Ukraine, and to reassert its influence, or even hegemony, over Eastern Europe. So where is this leading? Well, we'll soon know, he says. We'll soon know what comes next for NATO. Mr. Trump's inauguration is next week. And 2017, I mean, this is going to be a decisive year. It says, finally, in this piece by Joschka Fischer, he's the former German foreign minister and vice chancellor, by the way, but he says here at Project Syndicate, the English version, the old EU developed into an economic power because it was protected beneath the U.S. security umbrella. I mean, just think about the bigger picture of this. Given what we know about Bible prophecy, given that we knew, Herbert Armstrong knew, coming out of World War II, when Germany was in rubble, when Japan was in rubble, he knew there was going to be one final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire in Europe. And so here was this powerful umbrella, this U.S. security umbrella that allowed the EU to develop into an economic powerhouse. And now the umbrella is being removed. And now the umbrella is being taken down. He says, but without this guarantee, it can address its current geopolitical realities only by developing its own capacity to project political and military power. It says here, six decades after the Treaty of Rome established the European Economic Community, history and current developments are pushing France and Germany to shape Europe's future once again. It's current events and history, he says. History is pushing Germany. It's pushing France in this age-old direction. Why, this is just history repeating itself. He got that right. But we need to be honest about that history. We need to be honest about those empires, Charlemagne, Hitler, and the others. The brutality, the rivers of blood. History and current developments are pushing France and Germany to shape Europe's future once again. Well, on Wednesday, remember I went through that piece. I didn't have time to get through all of it. From Jay Nordlinger at National Review, the call to arms, that article where he talked about the military of Germany. Germany, Japan, and their militaries. That's what he's writing about. And in that piece, I didn't have time to get to this Wednesday, He quotes Constanze Stelzenmüller, an expert on Germany and Europe at the Brookings Institute. And she notes, this is quoting the article, she notes a dog not barking, a lack of protest. Notice what she highlights here. A lack of protest within Germany over the government's new direction. So the new direction now is that we've got to militarize ourselves. Okay, the U.S. security umbrella is being taken down. And so this is all the talk from 2016. These are all the plans. This is how it's going forward. And as she brings out, there's nobody protesting it. There's nobody saying, well, hang on a second. Is that the direction we want to go? You just have more and more voices like Joschka Fischer saying that, well, current events and history tell us this is the way we should be going. We've got to push for this now. Well, this expert from the Brookings Institute, she says there's a lack of protest in Europe at large as well. And I gave you those quotes on Wednesday's show. All of these leaders, remember the Polish diplomat. I may be the first one to say this, but I'm more frightened by an inactive Germany than I am about one that really takes the lead and shows some force here. All of these European leaders now stepping forward saying, come on, Germany, lead us. Come on, take charge. She says here, yes, there is some dissatisfaction as from the left party, but generally there is agreement or acceptance. This is an amazing contrast, she says. Listen to this. This is an amazing contrast with the huge protests that took place over the installation of U.S. missiles in the early 1980s. I mean, Europeans were up in arms. We don't want these missiles. We don't want this defense. We don't want this militarization. What a difference. Now the umbrella's almost gone, and you have all these voices stepping up because they see the current developments, like Fischer brought out. They see what Putin is doing. They see what's coming out of the Middle East and North Africa. And they see how weak the United States is. And they see Britain leaving. And they see Britain. Britain's no longer going to be a lead voice in NATO. And so they're not just the leaders, but even the general sentiment among the general populace. As she notes, what a contrast. You compare it to the early 1980s. Today, there's not even a dog barking. There's no one sounding the alarm. No one. It says, visiting Lithuania in September, the German defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, made a declaration. You've heard this before, but it's worth repeating here. She said, it's time to move forward to a European defense union. She said that such a union would complement and strengthen NATO. Plus, it's what the Americans expect us to do. I mean, it's time to go forward with this defense union. The Americans want this. We have to. A few months earlier, Lithuanian President Grybauskait had made a telling statement, with Britain withdrawing from the European Union but remaining a NATO member, responsibility for stability in Europe will increasingly fall on the shoulders of Germany, not only for economic stability, but also for security. Also for security. It goes on and says, Germany's the indispensable player here. And then the article concludes with commenting from one of these voices saying that there's a general sense that there's a tsunami heading Europe's way. 2017, what a year this is going to be. This is a momentous year for Germany, just like Fischer brings out in his piece. This is going to be a decisive year. And so, as I say, you're going to be hearing a lot about it on this program. And reading a lot about it at thetrumpet.com. How could we not? I mean, I played those clips for you on Wednesday and gave you those quotes from Mr. Armstrong talking about this very thing happening in the 1950s and 60s. Pretty amazing. Prophecy being fulfilled right before our eyes. And as is brought out in that piece, there's not even one dog barking. No one's out there warning. No one's out there saying, maybe this isn't a good idea. It's just all systems go. And everyone's behind it. Now, look, there's some political turmoil in the continent or on the continent for sure. But where are the protests? If they protested something like that U.S. defense in the 1980s, what about today? With all this talk of an EU military, with all this talk of Germany taking the lead, not just economically, but with respect to security as well. Now, when you put it together, as I said at the top of the show, this development here in Europe, when you put it together with this piece at The Week, the myth of America's invincible military, I mean, these are frightening developments. If we didn't know what Bible prophecy says, it should be frightening. But of course, we know that all of this is prophesied. And we know it's just bringing us 1, 2, 3, 4 steps closer to the return of Christ. In this piece here, Pascal Emmanuel Gabri, he's writing at The Week, talking about some relatively recent history. How that in the lead up to the Second World War, I mean, France, you look back on France's stunning collapse in the face of that Nazi invasion, and, well, you think, well, how could we be surprised by that? What did it happen in, like, 6 weeks? But as he brings out in his article, at that time, it stunned the world. Nobody thought France would fall that quickly. And why is that? Well, because they were seen as one of the preeminent superpowers of the day. They had a strong military. They had one of the world's biggest land armies. They had one of the world's biggest navies. That was France. And they collapsed within weeks. Is there a lesson we can take away from this? It says here, moreover, as France had led the Allies in World War I, a war that was orders of magnitude more terrible than anything anyone had ever known, it had a reputation for military invincibility. It had that during the World War I era. But look at how quickly it changed. Just that short little recess between the two wars, and then the rise of Nazism, and then the collapse of France within weeks. Within weeks. You can see where he's going in this piece. It says, today, global peace rests on many things, but one of them is the assumption that the United States military is invincible. But just like France's invincibility on the eve of World War II, America's military invincibility may just be waiting to be toppled by anyone clever and gutsy enough to give the right shove. And then he gives three worrying ways that America's war machine could be outclassed or could be toppled. He says, firstly, the reliance on supercarriers. I mean, you look at the aircraft carriers that we have, I think 10 of them, and it makes America, at least on paper, look like it's totally dominating the seas. And when you compare it to what other countries have, I mean, you could argue that for sure. But here's the thing, as he writes, just like France's outdated tactics were obsoleted by German Blitzkrieg, carrier strike groups, a technology in formation from the mid-20th century, are probably obsolete. They're probably obsolete. As an excellent article by David W. Wise convincingly argues, aircraft carriers are probably extremely vulnerable to a number of new technologies, from asymmetric warfare to super quiet submarines to advanced ballistic missiles. It says in military exercises, U.S. aircraft carriers keep getting sunk. That's what keeps happening in military exercises. Okay, so what happens when the real war happens? Well, I suppose military strategists could debate that. But look, you know where this is headed, because we have the advantage of Bible prophecy. He writes, up until very recently, America's overwhelming carrier advantage meant that any attempt, say, by China to invade Taiwan looked like folly. Now it practically looks like an invitation. With its anti-ship ballistic missiles, China could sink half the U.S. Navy before it even got within range of the island. So China doesn't have all the aircraft carriers. They've just got one, and it's an old one. But what they do have is anti-ship ballistic missiles. It increasingly looks like the Navy of the future will mostly consist of drone and missile-launching submarines, manned and unmanned, which hold a number of decisive advantages over carriers. But these are areas in which the Navy, despite some interesting experiments, is underinvesting, partly because its budget is being eaten up by a frenzy to build and maintain ever more expensive supercarriers. Now, we've talked a lot about in recent weeks or recent months about how the budget has been slashed, how the military has been hollowed out by this administration in particular, the Obama administration. And then we've looked at the massive budget that goes to the Pentagon and analyzed how that's spent, where it's spent. What does the Bible say? Leviticus 26, your strength is spent in vain. You have all this strength. You'll have this show, this display of power. But the pride is broken, the pride and the power, and then the strength is spent in vain. That's what Leviticus 26 says. And it's happening. It's all happening. In addition to that, there's an over-reliance on stealth fighters. And he brings out in his piece how that, obviously, just like with the sea, and World War II brought this out as well, the importance of dominating the air as well. He uses a more recent example, in fact, with Israel's Six-Day War, and how that some historians said that that should really be called the One-Day War, because once Israel's massive air power got going, I mean, it was over before it even got started. Because of that superiority in the air. It says, so making sure that in any conventional war, the United States can establish and maintain air dominance, it's front and center for all the strategic planners at the Pentagon. Thankfully, they have a silver bullet, stealth. All of the U.S. fighter jets will be stealthy. And when you can't even show up on the enemy's radar screens and you can shoot at them with impunity, you're going to crush them very quickly, right? Billions and billions and billions were poured into projects such as the F-35 and the F-22. And crucial design trade-offs were made so that those planes could have stealth technology. But there are two problems, he says. One is that Russia and China are also building their own stealth fighters. And the other is that stealth technology isn't actually all that stealthy. In a development that will shock only those who don't know anything about the history of warfare, America's competitors have come up with technologies to counter these gizmos. In fact, a number of new technologies, including active and passive radars, are pretty good at detecting so-called stealth planes. It says here, finally, the U.S. Air Force's strategic objective is to have enough of an edge, whether technological or organizational, that it can easily crush a rival's air force. The method for doing so since the early 1990s has been stealth, stealth. But now we need something new. We've got to keep up with the ever-changing technologies. Lastly, he brings out here networks and satellites. So you have the over-reliance on aircraft carriers, on stealth technology, and on satellites, and over-dependence. It says, since 2003, the U.S. has tried a bit of network-centric warfare of its own, and while the idea of using technology to enable various elements on the battlefield to communicate more efficiently and to enable commanders to have better information is tautologically sound, it isn't the game changer so many in the Pentagon seem to think it is. A network-enabled force is great if your networks work. A network-enabled force is great so long as the networks work. That brings to mind another prophecy from Ezekiel 7, where it says that when the trumpet of alarm sounds, no one's going to go out to battle. No one's going to go out to battle. This article here, just to conclude, it says satellites are enormously vulnerable. Anti-satellite missiles are a thing. Why wouldn't the Russians knock down the United States network in the first move of an engagement, leaving its military deaf, blind, and dumb? Well, of course they're going to go after that first. They're going to knock out the power. They're going to knock out the lights. And the U.S. military is going to be left with old school technology. Candles, you could say. Of course they're going to aim for that first. Now, we've been talking about this since 1995, over 20 years. About this coming downfall and destruction of the U.S. and Britain. And it's going to be a combination of destructive forces for sure. Financial ruin's going to factor in heavily. Drought, famine, disease, all of this is prophesied. Social unrest and war. And then foreign invasion. And as part of all of that, you have cyber warfare. And look at what's been in the news just in the last few months. That's all we've been hearing about. And what has the current or the outgoing administration done these past 8 years to counter it? All these attacks from the Chinese and the Russians. Well, keep in mind that prophecy in Ezekiel 7. When they blow the trumpet, nobody's going to be ready for war. And this is how he concludes his piece. If I'm right about any of this, it means that the United States military is glaringly vulnerable to a devastating attack in a way disturbingly similar to the heretofore invincible 1940 French military. And he says, if I know this, I'm sure there are people in Moscow and Beijing who do too. I mean, if I know about these vulnerabilities, you don't think the Russians know? You don't think the Chinese know? You don't think the Iranians know? You don't think the Germans know? It's astounding. All this happening, even as so many of God's people are fast asleep, just snoozing away, in darkness, blind, blind to what's happening in this world, in the last hour of this age. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us. We're coming up on the weekend now, so we need more emails that we can go through next week. You can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
I told you I had too much material, so there's some material here. We're going to have to skip the Bible study portion in particular about the paradox of our day and our diligent search for truth in a world where there are so many lies, so many falsehoods, so many fables, as the Bible talks about. Well, we'll get into that more next week, but I've got to get to some of these stats I can't believe it's Friday, and I haven't yet told you about the numbers that came in from last weekend. The most important book since the Bible. That's our Mystery of the Ages. Repeat. We've repeated it 5 times. We played it originally and have repeated it 5 times since. 6 times we've played this program. And the number of requests that came in for Mystery of the Ages, would you believe it was 202? We got over 200 once again with this repeat. 202 requests for the greatest work of Mr. Armstrong's life, Mystery of the Ages. The weekend previous to that, whatever happened to the church that Jesus established, we advertised that church history book, the new one we had from last year, and the updated responses to that show, 117. So as I say, that one was followed up by another big response to the most important book since the Bible. Also, some statistics on, again, from last year, and should have gotten to these earlier in this year. It's already, what is it, January the 13th. In any event, the numbers are in from this year that was, 2016, and regarding the mail or the literature that we're distributing out of this office, the UK office here at Edstone, 2016 was our biggest year yet in terms of literature distribution. We distributed 29,000 pieces of literature from the UK office. Now, that doesn't include the Trumpet magazine. Every month, I think it's somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500 Trumpet subscribers in this particular region. But in addition to that, 29,000 pieces of literature, most of that were letters and booklets, 11,700 booklets, 4,300 books, and 4,600 correspondence course lessons. We had, I think all total, we had 813 students enrolling in the correspondence course last year. And that was something, and we're going to do it again today with the program that we tape here in just a bit. But that was something that we advertised a fair bit last year. Those programs advertising the correspondence course, they generally brought in a little bit of a lower response, but here again, the cumulative effect, it's been pretty good with that many students adding to the list. As far as TV response overall, the TV program here in the UK, in total, it generated 8,200 requests for literature, and so that averaged out to about 160 calls, text messages, or orders online in direct response to the television program. The literature that we distributed last year in 2016, as far as books and booklets go, the biggest one or the biggest number was The United States and Britain in Prophecy. That was at 1,300. And then right behind that, Mystery of the Ages, 1,156. That's the year after that goal for 2015, which we met. 2,000 Mystery of the Ages that went out. But then again, last year, we didn't really set a goal for one in particular. We kind of spread it out, having the most programs for Mystery of the Ages, U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, and the Correspondence Course. And so that's why the numbers are a little more spread out. And then there's also some pretty encouraging stats here with respect to those contacting ministers of the Philadelphia Church of God. There's been a really nice upswing in that as well, just in the last 3 years. A few emails here, this one in response to Mr. Morley's show, Robert Morley's show yesterday, Trump's Wall and World War III. It says the real cause of our economic woes is not disclosed to even the highest minds among business analysts, nor our best intentioned politicians. Here is the great wall of all, it says. As Trump may be very good at building walls, so are our enemies at building wrecking balls. Well, that ties in with what we concluded with in the last segment. Another one here in response to Robert Morley's show. If you didn't hear that yesterday, by the way, you can listen to the podcast at thetrumpet.com or at kpcg.fm. This one here from a gal in Massachusetts. I wanted to take a moment to express appreciation for Mr. Morley's show yesterday when he filled in on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I was just thinking recently that it was too bad not to to hear as much from him on the Trumpet Hour, which is not to say that the other men don't provide knowledgeable and captivating presentations, because they surely do. I would say that the complexities of economics escape me more than other topics, and I always appreciate Mr. Morley's clear handle on this aspect of our world. Since the very beginning of following PCG and the Trumpet, I've always looked for his analysis when I need to make sense of the world in this area. On a few occasions, I've wanted him to bring his knowledge even further down to a 101 level, because my understanding is so basic. Having him cover Mr. Trump's media conference for an extended show really helped do this in some areas for me. After listening, I felt clearer on many of the details and the big picture. His coverage of this topic and the associated viewpoints and historical parallels was really clear and easy to follow. She says, finally, it made the economic implications of our current situation much more digestible, relating to both history and prophecy. It's always really neat and inspiring to see the specific ways that God works through different people. And that is true. We've got quite a few personalities contributing to the effort here on KPCG and at the Trumpet website as well. But the radio station in particular, I think there's just a lot. If you've listened to this program and some of the others, you do have lots of variety, and you can see the specific ways that God works through different people. Well, we do miss having Robert Morley more involved in the radio programming, but to be sure, he's involved in God's work. He's just really working hard in a lot of other areas. But that's an excellent comment that hopefully he's out there listening to at the moment, because it makes me want to plug him in as a sub for me more often. We'll see. Another one in response to Wednesday's show. This is the one I gave on that farewell speech by President Obama. It says, I really appreciated yesterday's program. That would be Wednesday's. The highlights from President Obama's speech were very telling. After 8 years in office, during a speech which concluded that the 8 years had been a success, that was really ridiculous. And then to belittle the Constitution, he's clever at disguising what he's doing, but really his type of speech is not that different from a person who approaches you and says, no offense, but, and then she says, it's all just an attack. This one here also came in response to that farewell address. It's from one of our listeners in Portland who writes, I really appreciated the Trumpet Daily Radio Show content today, as I always have with KPCG. I was excited for this one as I had watched President Obama's farewell speech live. It was glaringly obvious to me that the fruits of his presidency are the polar opposite of so many of his statements and platitudes that he spoke of. I knew the program would amplify my understanding of it all, and it did, as it always has. What a blessing. I also enjoyed the clip of Senator Cruz bringing up much of the double standards and corruption, kind of rare, it seems. He says, finally, so much of the thinking we see coming from the radical left comes right out of the books like the Communist Manifesto and Rules for Radicals. Our people are forsaking the great God that made us great and inspired our Constitution to essentially another God and a foreign style of government. That's what our people want. And of course, really, hasn't that been Israel's weakness anciently when you look at the Old Testament? That's what Israelites have typically wanted. Even after good leadership, even after righteous leadership, that's been their glaring weakness, to want to go after the other customs and traditions and even the leaders of foreign nations. Another one here, it says, this burden of Germany's to now defend itself and Europe as being the heart of it is a burden that will become so heavy as to make the earth shake as it's carried, as it is carried, and with the weight of the burden being overcome by the strong shoulders of Germany, it will be carried on to conquer the weight and mass of this world, with the whole world trembling under its footsteps. It says here, now that many are left to fear with nothing to cover them, left naked as the cloth of Manasseh's banner is removed around the world, It is in this cold fear, a German flag does begin to look comforting. Another one here in response to, I believe this would have been Tuesday's program, where we talked about that truck ramming in Jerusalem. It says, I caught your Tuesday broadcast. I must say you gave an incredibly eye-opening and informative show. Thank you so much for the wonderful perspective on fasting. That was the second segment, I believe, on fasting and prayer and God's viewpoint on how we should be doing it. Also, I just want to thank you and your staff for the great work you do on all of your programs. Truly, God has been working with and through you. I've been listening to your radio programs from the beginning. I'm amazed at how much your station has grown in the short amount of time that it's been on the air. Undoubtedly, God is behind it all. Keep up the great work. And you, dear listener, keep up sending in those emails. That's your weekly assignment. And that's all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for joining us this week. We'll see you next time.